Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. What an amazing day. Thanks so much for joining us for a special hour of coverage on the Supreme Court's long-awaited decision on health care. A 5-4 ruling, narrow, argumentative, showing once again a sharply divided court, but upholding the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, the Obama health care law, Obamacare, call it what you will. The details of this decision speak volumes about the rule of law in the United States versus the role of politics in embracing or sometimes dodging hard choices.
Let's get the basic details out for you. At a quarter after 10 this morning, 9 justices emerged from their chambers to deliver their ruling. They had 4 questions to address, but the heart of the ACA was the individual mandate that forces Americans to buy health insurance or face penalties. The government had argued that was constitutional, the mandate, under what's known as the Commerce Clause, because if people are uninsured and require treatment, that cost then gets passed on to insurance companies and increased costs for those who are insured. 4 of the justices, that would be Ginsburg, Kagan, Sotomayor, and Breyer, agreed with that. Chief Justice Roberts also upheld the individual mandate, but he didn't accept the Commerce Clause justification. Roberts said the mandate was acceptable if it's seen as a tax. The dissenting justices were Scalia, Thomas, Kennedy, and Alito. Justice Kennedy called the law a vast judicial overreach that undermines state sovereignty. But the majority rules quite literally at the Supreme Court. That means nearly all of the Affordable Care Act will stand as signed by the president. The only thing that was not upheld was the provision that compelled states to comply with the Medicaid expansion or risk losing all of their Medicaid funding. The court decided the government can only restrict new funds, not all of them. So for President Obama, perhaps a sigh of relief today.
The highest court in the land has now spoken. We will continue to implement this law, and we'll work together to improve on it where we can. But what we won't do, what the country can't afford to do, is refight the political battles of 2 years ago or go back to the way things were. With today's announcement, it's time for us to move forward, to implement and, where necessary, improve on this law. And now's the time to keep our focus on the most urgent challenge of our time, putting people back to work, paying down our debt, and building an economy where people can have confidence that if they work hard, they can get ahead. But today, I'm as confident as ever that when we look back 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, or 20 years from now, we'll be better off because we had the courage to pass this law and keep moving forward.
But the Supreme Court decision for Mitt Romney, perhaps, was a call to arms.
We must replace Obamacare. That is my mission. That is our work. And I'm asking the people of America to join me. If you don't want the course that President Obama has put us on, if you want instead a course that the founders envisioned, then join me in this effort. Help us. Help us defeat Obamacare. Help us defeat the liberal agenda that makes government too big, too intrusive, and that's killing jobs across this great country.
And you can hear it there. As is always the case in our political system, the health care policy debate is renewed in the political sphere in the aftermath of a court decision. We will be looking at that all hour long. The legal arguments expounded today now form part of the body of precedents that will guide future courts and Congresses. Chief Justice John Roberts reminded us today that this is how it should be. In his majority opinion, he wrote this: "We do not consider whether the act embodies sound policies. That judgment is entrusted to the nation's elected leaders. We ask only whether Congress has the power under the Constitution to enact the challenged provisions." And today the answer to that question is yes, Congress has that power. Joining us now and for the hour, Dr. Perry Klass, professor of pediatrics and journalism at New York University. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you.
And Nate Persily, Charles Beekman, professor of law and political science at Columbia University, longtime friend of the program, as is Dr. Klass. Nate Persily, welcome back.
Thank you.
So, Nate, let's just begin. First of all, the tax question that Celeste laid out there, the idea that a mandate can work if it's a tax, is that a novel legal argument by Justice Roberts to justify this majority opinion?
Well, it was one of the arguments that the Solicitor General, who argued for the United States, put forward, but it was his third argument. The first argument was this Commerce Clause argument that Celeste mentioned and that everyone thought would be the critical issue in the case. It is a backup argument and one that's not frequently use because there are more laws that are justified under the Commerce Clause than under the Taxing Clause. So it's novel and unexpected. I think everyone's surprised that this was the rationale for how the case was going to be resolved. But a lot of people thought that maybe Chief Justice Roberts would sort of step away from the brink and step away from the potential criticism that would emerge if they had had five votes to strike down the entire ACA.
Does this decision suggest there's virtually no limit on Congress's power to compel people to do things using the tax system?
They actually leave open the question as to what the limits on the taxing power are. First, they and for that matter, all nine justices really do. The question that divides them is whether this is a tax or not. And Chief Justice Roberts and the former liberal justices say, yes, it is a tax, and so therefore it's within the taxing power. And they don't get really into that question.
On the question of extending Medicaid, this was struck down. Only new money can be withheld from the states if they don't go along with an edict of this kind. Does that open the possibility of challenging other federal sort of reimbursement laws in, say, Title IX, civil rights legislation, that sort of thing?
That is in some ways, I think, what's going to be seen as the most significant part of this decision going forward, because the court has really never in the last 80 years or so struck down a spending clause exercised by Congress. And one thing it's important to note that this is a 7-2 decision on the spending question. It's not just 5-4 like the others. And Congress spends a lot of money, and that is a power that's more frequently used, whether you're talking about, as you said, education funding, which gives about 10% of states funding that they spend, or all kinds of other pieces of legislation. So we will see whether this sort of metastasizes to other areas of the law.
But this will be revisited. Dr. Klass, taxes, questions of federal spending, in terms of people who have to live health care and health care decisions, families, doctors, et cetera, where do you think this decision leaves us?
Well, you know, we're at a turning point in the medical year here. It's about to be July. The new interns are going to start. Last year's interns are going to be supervising them. This group of young doctors are coming out and beginning to practice in a country in which maybe they're going to be able to assume that every single person has some kind of coverage and access to health care. And maybe that they're going to be thinking about what's best for patients, what people need to be healthy, what you need to put in place. And that's a new world. As a pediatrician, I think we're a lot of us really, really celebrating the American Academy of Pediatrics supported this act and has pointed out again and again all the different ways that for children and their families and the people who take care of them, this matters so much, this coverage, this extension of coverage, what happens to the children with serious medical problems who grow up into the adults with so-called pre-existing conditions, right? If you take care of children with medical issues, those very photogenic, telegenic children with heartbreaking diseases, they grow up into adults with pre-existing conditions. If you take care of children and you get them healthy and balanced despite their medical problems to not be children anymore, what happens? Are they covered?
So this removes uncertainty for children, for families, and from the standpoint of a pediatrician, that is a really good thing that assists in your ability to practice medicine?
Absolutely. And I would just make the other obvious point that in order to keep children healthy and take care of children, as a society, we've been more willing to take care of children than of adults. In order to keep those children healthy, if their parents don't have health care, if their parents are trying to decide between losing the house or the fishing boat and taking care of their own medical problems, that's not good for children either for their health, their mental health, or their place in society. And like every pediatrician out there, I've said to a parent, well, he's fine, but you sound like you can't breathe. Or the baby's beautiful. Have you been back to the doctor yourself, ma'am, since you gave birth and come up against parents who don't have coverage and whose health and well-being I worry about for the sake of the adults, but also for the sake of the family and the child.
So for many, those obstructions removed. The view of a pediatrician, Dr. Perry Klass, professor of pediatrics and journalism at New York University, also a law professor's view, Nate Persily, Charles Beekman, professor of law and political science at Columbia. Those two voices with us all hour here on The Takeaway.
And also with us, we have Donna Salter, who's affected very personally by this healthcare ruling. Can you tell us your story?
Well, basically, I was laid off last August, and even though I'd had health care for about 30 years, I was without health care. I could not afford the COBRA on my unemployment insurance, And I fell down and broke my leg in January. And without insurance, from the moment that the ambulance drivers arrived, they asked me if I owned my home. And I said yes. And they told me, do not go to the hospital because you won't own your home by the time you're finished with this.
The ambulance drivers.
The ambulance drivers. And so they carried me to a friend's car and told her to take me to an Emeta center where I would also be stabilized. But may be able to make some choices about my own treatment for the future.
And what kind of choices did you have to make based on whether or not you could pay?
Well, it was very hard to find anybody who would take me for cash, number one. It was very hard to find anybody other than in Mumbai, Canada, and Mexico who would give me a price for the treatment that I required. It was just very vague, $100,000. It was impossible to get people to take me as a patient. MRIs ranged in price from $350 to $3,500. And mostly I was just up against, no, we won't see you. You do not have insurance.
And so you were actually contemplating a move out of the country.
Yes, I was planning to either move back to Canada or I was planning to go to Mexico, one of the two.
In order to get health care for your leg.
Right.
So this decision today means what for you?
I just think it means that the country overall has an opportunity to get decent care, and everybody should have that opportunity, not just some people.
And you can stay in the country.
And I can stay in the – I have a job again, so I can stay in the country, yes.
You can now. And you can – get your leg taken. I mean, how is your leg now?
Well, I've just had an operation 3 weeks ago, and that was as a result of Obamacare, by the way, because my state already had introduced the provision. And so I was able to get health care for pre-existing conditions.
Because of that had already been implemented.
It had already been implemented in my state, even though the federal program has not yet been implemented.
So you'll remember this day.
I will remember this day, and I think it's a great day.
Those assault. Two crutches against the wall.
I know, she's got them leaning up there. Yeah. But a successful surgery, I certainly hope. Donna Salter, healthcare professional who's benefited from the Affordable Care Act. Now, thank goodness, okay. But we'd love to get your stories also about how the Healthcare Act, the Affordable Care Act, and this Supreme Court decision affects you personally, just like Donna. 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can post your comment to thetakeaway.org.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. This is our special coverage of today's healthcare ruling from the Supreme Court. We want to thank all of our listeners, including those who are listening on KGUA FM in California.
In wine country.
Yeah, absolutely. Mendocino right. County, absolutely. KUOW in Seattle, KUVO in Colorado. Hope you guys are all safe away from the wildfires. Thanks again for joining us. Obviously, the debate over the Affordable Care Act has centered not just on healthcare outcomes, but on politics as well, each party maintaining their own message.
We're very, very excited about this day. It's historic. It ranks right up there when they passed Social Security and Medicare and now being upheld by five justices of the Supreme Court.
This is certainly a historic day in our country, but not a day to deepen our divisions or throw up our hands and celebrate and say our work is done.
This is a great win for the country and the American people.
Let me guess. Those are Democrats?
Those are all Democrats. Yeah. Nancy Pelosi of California, Emanuel Cleaver of Missouri, and Chris Van Hollen of Maryland. Republicans also want to use the Supreme Court decision to mobilize their base. Here's the message you're going to hear, and you're going to hear it again and again from the GOP all right up until November.
We passed plenty of terrible laws around here that the court finds constitutional. Constitutionality was never an argument to keep this law in place.
When we return the week of July 9th, I've scheduled a vote for total repeal of the Obamacare bill to occur on Wednesday, July 11th.
Today's ruling underscores the urgency of repealing this harmful law in its entirety.
And you may recognize all of those voices, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, Eric Cantor of Virginia, and John Boehner of Ohio. So we have our Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick, with us. Todd, you've been watching all of these responses. Can you kind of lay out how this may affect both parties and the presidential campaign?
Yes, Celestia. Hi. I was actually in the room for, I think, almost all of those statements throughout the day. It's been a whirlwind, and you're right to play them all because this really is the marquee banner issue of the election going forward, and certainly of President Obama's first term. Now, election going forward, that's folded underneath the banner of the economy and jobs. The health care is part of that, and voters confirm that they think it's part of it. You know, Republicans, as you said, are going right back to repeal. Their base demands it. It has been their message the entire time. It is Mitt Romney's platform that if elected, he will move to repeal Obamacare immediately. But I think we have to wait and see what they're talking about in October. They're certainly talking about it now. They're reacting to the decision with full repeal. You heard all the leaders say it there. And they will do that. Will Mitt Romney carry that message into November? It will depend on what the public is saying. Certainly the base is ginned up about repealing Obamacare, and the bill remains in the aggregate relatively unpopular with voters, but that doesn't mean that the sort of 47% of people who say they don't favor the law want the president, want their senator, want the politicians to be hammering away at repeal at the expense of other things like, you know, jobs, like economy, like the fiscal cliff,
yeah,
like the debt and things like that. So we'll see in October if they're still talking about this.
Certainly, because the Health Care Act comes in as a very distant second after the economy when it comes to voters' priorities. That's Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
Pollsters are going to work to find out what the numbers are here, that's for sure. And so let's take a look at our panel. Nate Persily from Columbia University and Perry Class, pediatrician and a doctor and professor of journalism at NYU. You know, in terms of the politics, do you think this is a situation, Nate Persily, where the legal system and the rule of law kind of work together to clarify a policy? Are they in conflict in some way? Does this constitute kind of a technicality from what most people think, that the government should be helping keep people healthy, not arguing about taxes at this moment in history? And that's what the presidential campaign is going to come down to, Nate.
Well, let's just focusing on the Supreme Court decision. What Supreme Court decisions do is they elevate an issue onto the agenda for a particular period of time. That's true whether it's dealing with gay rights or with immigration or health care. And so for the next period, we're going to be talking about that. And the question as to how this plays politically is, well, what's sort of the signals that people are getting about the health care law? Does this provide an opportunity for Democrats, for example, to tout its accomplishments? If you look at President Obama's statement today, right afterwards, he tried to not talk about the legal issue, but really to focus and try to sell the law in ways that maybe he hasn't been so successful in doing so. But it also plays into the meme that the Republicans have been proffering about big government and the Tea Party standard line about that the government's gotten too big and that's a problem, deficits, et cetera.
And all that's going to go on in the presidential campaign. What does this say about the Roberts Court? It seems like he tried to get a 6-3 decision. He got a 7-2 on the Medicaid, as you pointed out. But he tried to get a wider majority and failed on some level. I'm wondering if this is a personal legacy for him.
Well, I think that he bought a lot of political capital with this decision, and he knows it, that the fact that he has cast a critical vote in order to uphold the signature achievement of a Democratic president buys him the ability to craft other types of decisions in other contexts. So that if you had put this together with Bush versus Gore, which preexisted the Roberts Court, or Citizens United, which is the signature decision of the Roberts Court, and then you put a overturning of health care with that group of decisions, that would have been a problem from a political standpoint. And we saw up till this decision that there was increasing sort of partisanship in people's views of the Supreme Court, that if they thought of it as a Republican institution, then they would have reacted accordingly.
The politicization of the court.
And I wonder, Dr. Perry Class, you're a professor of pediatrics journalism at NYU. So, I mean, this law may be a work in progress for you and your fellow doctors. I mean, there are many doctors coming out now and saying, yes, this is a great first step, but the discussion of healthcare as we move forward isn't about whether to repeal it or not, but how to then improve it.
And I think the president said that also today, that there's going to be opportunities state by state to figure out how to do this well, how to do it better as we go. And I would, you know, as someone who's neither a lawyer nor a politico, I would just make the very obvious point about all those voices we just heard. What do they all have in common? They don't agree on anything, but they've all got coverage. Every single one of those legislators, their families, they've got great coverage. And I think, you know, it's may turn out to be an awkward position to be saying, well, we've got coverage, but you can't have it.
But one of the things that Celeste and I learn every morning on this program, every day on this program, is how the political debate on health care has made its way into virtually every family's dinner table conversation. Here's Ponca City, Oklahoma, a listener saying, my concern is more about moving forward after the decision. It still seems unclear how all the ins and outs of the legislation are going to affect hospitals and individuals. Akron, Ohio, I wish the root cause of the problem, rising costs, were addressed before this law was passed. Nothing is being done to solve the fundamental issue. I suspect your patients, the families that you deal with, think about that rising cost issue all the time.
I think that one thing that probably is good is that we're talking about it, that we're aware of it, that we're not saying, you know, leave the thinking on health care and costs to the experts. They'll take care of you. I don't think the public believes that we can do that anymore. There are too many questions about how we exist as a society, how we spend our money, what we do and don't spend it on, who gets what. And people do need to talk about this and think about this at the dinner table. And it is going to be a work in progress. But if the direction of the progress is toward better health care and a better sense of security for more people, that's not going to be something that people are going to want to see diminish.
But I wonder, Nate, to go back to the question of what this means for Chief Justice Roberts, because he's clearly the pivotal person here. I mean, the guy is only 57 years old. He has a lot of years left in him as Chief Justice. What does this tell us about the shape of the court to come?
Well, I think that whoever's elected president will possibly get one or two more picks to the Supreme Court, and those picks could affect what the majority is right now. It is still the case that it's largely a 4-4 court. Normally, we thought that Justice Kennedy was the swing justice. Well,
yeah.
It turns out Chief Justice Roberts can be as well. And he's used that in different decisions throughout his term. Let me say one thing about what's coming up at the Supreme Court and how this plays into it. So next year, they're probably going to be dealing with same-sex marriage, constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act, and affirmative action. Okay, all very hot topics. It's likely that at least two of those three that they're going to take a more conservative view. If someone were to criticize the Roberts Court as being sort of consistently Republican, consistently conservative, well, there's this decision out there, this major decision which can be waived in
front
of them.
But he's now shown himself to be the umpire that he said he would be during his confirmation hearings.
Well, I don't know whether it plays into that. I mean, I tend to think that all of these justices are players in some respect in addition to umpire. But you know, in the end, you cannot say that he has a reliable vote for the Republican position in these things. And the constitutional arguments, which had been seen as off the wall a year or 2 years ago when it came to this case, then came into the mainstream. And if you look even at the Kagan and Sotomayor confirmation hearings, that became part of the question as to how they would behave on the court. If you remember, I believe it was Tom Coburn asked Justice Kagan, can the federal government force you to eat broccoli, right?
Right.
And she didn't take the bait and said, well, that would be a stupid law, but I'm not going to talk about the constitutionality, because as you can see in the opinions today, where they use the broccoli argument as well, that they say, well, look, if you can't force Americans to buy broccoli, you can't force them to pay for health insurance, right? And so there is a kind of congealing of the political world and the legal world, the constitutional discourse, in ways that maybe we only get every few years.
That's Nate Persily, professor of law and political science at Columbia University. Also with us all hour, Dr. Perry Klass, professor of pediatrics and journalism at New York University. And we're still getting your responses to the healthcare law as well. A Florida listener texts this: huge disappointment that such a poorly conceived and executed law would stand. It ignores most of the factors required to improve the state of healthcare in this country. And from Brooklyn, Brian says, does the Supreme Court's ruling on healthcare mean that the federal government can force individuals to do almost anything by taxing them if they do not do it? That's the broccoli argument there. You can give us your response at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
From all over the country, voices, it's been a long time coming. This Supreme Court drama was in the cards almost from the moment the Affordable Care Act passed the Congress. And so This is an emotional day for many Americans, for whom waiting to learn if Obamacare would live or die in the courts has been quite literally a matter of life and death.
I don't think in the last 10 years, there's probably one day that I have not thought about what I was going to do and how I was going to continue to provide health insurance for my son having hemophilia. The concern that I have is that these companies continue to choose profits over lives.
Brenda Neubauer there. Do you hear? She has a son with hemophilia. We spoke with her a little while ago. She was very, very concerned before the decision. Brenda, how are you feeling now?
Oh, I'm elated. I'm just absolutely elated. I'm a loss for words right now.
And what does this mean specifically? The concern that you had was that somehow the act being struck down would remove caps on coverage?
Well, in our state, I'm almost confident that it would have. In North Dakota, we're pretty much dominated by one insurance company, and they had come out that they were waiting the ruling of the Supreme Court before they would decide whether they would continue with some of the mandates, and the lifetime caps was one of them. So I was pretty confident that if the Supreme Court had struck down Obamacare, which I'll refer to it as unconstitutional, that we would have went back to the limits, the lifetime limits, and in our case, that was $2 million, which when you look at my son, he incurs over $500,000 per year. You know, that's really nothing.
Understood. So confidence for Brenda Neubauer there that the coverage will continue given this decision 5-4 by the Supreme Court. Joining us now also Karen Martin, an organizer of the Spartanburg, South Carolina Tea Party. Karen, how are you feeling today?
Well, I'm concerned that the taxpayers are now going to face the choice of either being embroiled in an IRS investigation or have to pay a hefty health care plan. I just don't think that that's the best solution for the health care situation that all Americans find themselves in.
Do you want the Republicans in the Congress and Mitt Romney to campaign on repealing Obamacare?
Yes, I do.
And do you have insurance?
I do. I pay my own insurance. I'm self-employed, so I pay about $500 a month to insure myself.
All right. Reactions from Americans around the country who are in different sides of the issue here. That's Karen Martin, an organizer of the Spartanburg, South Carolina Tea Party. Here's another voice we spoke with just before the court decision.
I have two kids. Because they have pre-existing conditions that will last a lifetime, they are chronically ill. Their future health is at stake.
It's Kathy McClure, a trial lawyer from Atlanta, Georgia, who hiked all the way to the steps of the Supreme Court to hear the decision. Kathy, how are you feeling right now?
I have a huge sense of relief for my children and for anyone else who suffers from any kind of pre-existing condition. This is huge.
So, Kathy, Karen, and Brenda, it's up to you three to figure out a way that Americans are going to get along on health care reform because the debate continues. Karen, what would you say to Kathy?
Well, to Kathy and Brenda, I share your concerns about having only one insurance provider in the state. I think that's been something that's been unfairly mandated to us as states. I would much rather see those caps lifted off and many insurance companies being able to provide services to states on a competitive basis rather than just the one per state. So I share that.
All right, Brenda Neubauer, what would you say to Karen?
Well, and don't get me wrong, we do have other insurance providers in our state, but the problem with that is that concern is there, but when it isn't an option to you, you have no other thing to turn to except high-risk pools, which may have a cap as well. So, you know, when you're faced with that situation, then you have to look towards the greater means, and that's the national government to get involved. And so I implore everybody to get involved and make sure that we do get out there and campaign to keep this in effect because we do need it. And there are a lot of people that are hoping and praying that we get out there and lobby that this stays in effect.
That's Brenda Neubauer, whose son has hemophilia, who has insurance coverage issues, as you can imagine. We're also speaking with Karen Martin, an organizer of the Spartanburg, South Carolina Tea Party. And Kathy McClure is with us, a trial lawyer from Atlanta, who also had a sense of relief at the decision today. Karen, I don't want to stack the deck against you. Let me get one more comment from Kathy, and I'll let you give us the last word. Kathy McClure, how are we going to all get along here now that this debate continues?
Well, I mean, I've got some good news for Karen. You know, she may be eligible for a premium credit or subsidy under the law. The law will set up exchanges, free market exchanges, so that Karen will be able to buy a policy from more than one provider in the state of South Carolina. So there's a lot of good in this law that nobody really knows about, and And, you know, most people think, oh, I'm going to have to do something. I won't be able to keep my insurance. Well, none of that is correct.
Thank you, Kathy McClure. Karen, I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, I have to disagree. I think there's so many things that are bad for the American citizens as far as personal liberty and law that outweigh that small niche of health care coverage. I still believe, and I think most Americans do, that the free market is the best solution for this, and we need to get on that.
There you have it. Thanks to Brenda Neubauer, to Karen Martin, an organizer of the Spartanburg, South Carolina Tea Party, and to Kathy McClure, a trial lawyer from Atlanta. All witnesses, as you are, our listeners, to this Supreme Court decision. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're listening to The Takeaway, special coverage of the Supreme Court decision to uphold the Affordable Care Act by a vote of 5-4. Our conversation and your conversation, join us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, continues after a break.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. Funding for Detroit coverage on The Takeaway is supported in part by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, WKKF.org. You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry, and you are listening to our special coverage of today's healthcare ruling from the Supreme Court. We want to thank all of our listeners, including those at WDET in Detroit, WNYC in New York, and KOPB in Portland, Oregon. So, if you are wondering how specifically this ruling affects you, what might change when you go to the doctor's office tomorrow, what might change when you go to the hospital, Pamela Breyer can help answer some of those questions. She's the president and CEO of Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. Nice to talk to you again, Pamela.
Nice to be here.
All right. So the Affordable Health Care Act is going to be implemented in a number of stages. So does anything change today or tomorrow that wasn't in place yesterday?
Nothing changes today or tomorrow that the law doesn't provide for. And in fact, we have been working at Maimonides and certainly across New York City and probably across the country on ways to do a better job of taking care of patients with less money. That is called payment reform, and the federal government and the state have been pushing hospitals to figure out ways to save the taxpayers money and do a better job of taking care of people. So that's going on. We actually got some seed money from the federal government that is referred to. We would have lost it if this law had not passed. So there's, I guess, about $10 billion set aside nationally to help hospitals do this. That's a good thing.
What kind of conversations, Pamela, will you now be able to have with your board of trustees, for example? Is it going to change the model of how you do business?
Well, I think that we are, as I said, we are being encouraged and pushed to change the way we do business so that, for example, we are trying very hard to manage the care of patients so they don't end up in the hospital. And that's pretty revolutionary for a hospital CEO to be working on. But just to take a step back for a minute, Celeste, the hospital industry in New York and in the country knew what it was doing when it supported this bill. And what it was doing was contributing $155 billion to help make sure that this individual mandate got paid for. So that's a good thing, but it's a costly thing. And every state's hospitals are going to be affected with Medicare reductions to help pay for this law. We think it's great that patients are going to be insured. We just think it's wonderful. We look forward to it. It's good for New York State because they will leverage more federal dollars. For hospitals, while there are some incentives, and certainly there'll be more insured patients in New York State, the federal outlook is really a lot more challenging, and we've told this to our board.
Well, maybe you can reassure our listener, Corinne. She writes us on Facebook, "It makes me fearful. My medical care that's already in place works very well. I can't help but wonder how this will change my much-needed care. All I can presently do is pray there won't be any monumental changes." So, Pamela, how does it change people who already have insurance?
Hopefully, it doesn't change at all, except for the issue that the way services are provided may change with or without that law all across the country. But we are looking forward to seeing more patients in our emergency room who weren't insured before, and we are hoping that we will continue to work for ways to improve care for patients. And in the short, nothing happens in terms of reductions from this law to hospitals until 2014. So in the short run, I think nothing is going to change. But over time, over the next 10 years, I think we'll see a change. Hopefully, patients will not be able to tell the difference.
Pamela Breyer, president and CEO of Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York, part of our panel as we discuss the 5-4 decision to uphold the Affordable Care Act. Also with us, Nate Persily, professor of law and political science at Columbia University, and Dr. Perry Klaus, professor of pediatrics and journalism at New York University. Nate, I have a legal question for you, but first of all, bearing on that discussion with Pamela Breyer there, who I understand both of you know her refined work here in the New York area, Dr. Perry Klaus, let's just assume that maybe the political classes will try to go back and sort of rehash some of the debates over whether we should have an Affordable Care Act or not. But if you're a medical practitioner, all right, maybe there are some aspects of the challenges in our healthcare system that this act begins to address. What's next? What's the tough sort of nut to crack going forward? Is it costs that need to come down? Is it some of the issues of preventive care that Pamela Breyer talked about? Is it a deeper cultural change to bring people into the healthcare system healthier from the get-go? Where do you think we go from
here? Can I only have one of those?
Any of them or none of them. You can say that's ridiculous, Mr. Hockenberry.
Oh, no, I wouldn't say that at all. In fact, I think a lot of those are probably have to happen in concert. I mean, I do primary care, and primary care matters hugely in terms of that other very important concept you raised, preventive care. That is to say, if we do this right, if we extend coverage, can we take care of people in such a way that they won't need as much of the biggest and the most expensive care? Can we, as you just heard someone say, hospitals trying to keep people out of hospitals? How do you keep people out of hospitals? How do you avoid using the emergency room instead of having effective primary care that takes care of little problems before they become emergencies, or that offers you a place to go so that you have, so that you're not in the emergency room? And we heard earlier from someone who was told by the EMTs, don't go to the hospital. Is there a way to set up the system to take care of people properly so that we can prevent some of those really bad things from happening? And that doesn't just save us money. It saves people from suffering.
On a legal question, Nate, let's go back to the Medicaid extension issue, because you explained it in the first block of our hour here. But that really is an invitation for a lot of legal challenges outside of healthcare. And I wonder if you'd explain it to us. The court said that the federal government can say to states, you can't have any new money if you don't follow our rules on Medicaid. The court said you can only do it on new money. You can't take all of the support, federal support, away. What challenges are invited for people to come in and say, actually, the federal government can't withdraw funding for things like sports, for things like civil rights, for things like employee quotas, for, say, highway contracts, federal contracts? Have we opened up a huge can of worms here?
The question that the court is trying to answer is, when does spending become coercive? And they said that, look, if you blackmail states into accepting this additional group of patients that are 133% above the poverty line, that you hold as the threat that we will take away what is essentially 20% of your state's budget, which is what Medicaid tends to constitute, that's coercive, that you've gone from spending money to basically regulating states and forcing them to accept it. Now, Medicaid is under one view, really just the exception, and that it is such a huge part of what states have to spend that there are very few things that are going to be coercive of that magnitude. But if you expand it beyond Medicaid and you say, well, look, there are all kinds of grants that we give to states that have conditions attached, not just to states as well. It's also to individuals. So for example, doctors are going to get certain money that's not just under this act, but even previously that says, all right, well, if you take federal money, then you cannot do X and Y. And so the question is, when does spending become coercive? And we will see. Generally speaking, the court has been extremely deferential when it comes to spending. That's been the area where Congress has the greatest latitude. This may just be a one-off where you look at Medicaid and you say it's just so coercive. Let me make one other point, and let me sort of add fuel to the Tea Party argument for a second, which is that this is a 2,700-page law that regulates the health care in ways that we really do not know the implications quite yet. In 2014, most of the key provisions are going into effect. None of us can predict exactly how the law itself is going to function, and also how the Medicaid the exchanges are going to work at the state level, and how states are going to react to these Medicaid expansions, the way that the court has sort of adjusted the law when it comes to Medicaid. Nevertheless, we also can't predict, even without this law, how the healthcare industry is going to behave in the next coming years. We have a huge law, and that was what was probably going to be necessary if we were going to provide insurance to the entire population. But I think it is too soon to tell both how it's going to play politically over the long term and actually how it's going to be administered, and for that matter, how a new president might administer this law. I mean, Mitt Romney has said that he's, on day one, he's going to grant exemptions to states, on all types of aspects of the law.
So Pamela Breyer, president and CEO of Maimonides Medical Center, is this a good planning principle, this Affordable Care Act now affirmed for an institution like yourself? Or do you really have to go it alone and come up with your own initiatives if you're going to solve some of these other challenges that exist in healthcare, some of which you've already enumerated?
So I think that a million people are going to be insured. A million additional people are going to be insured in New York State. That is, for a hospital, a very good thing. True, we are paying a share of that insurance, and that will start in 2014, as I said. But in addition, by regulation, if you will, not by legislation, changes in the way we do business are already underway, and they're going to continue with or without this bill. This bill certainly pushes us, but it certainly pushes us in the direction of preventive care, as Dr. Klass said, preventive care, better access to primary care. We've been plagued with a huge rise in bad debts. Not that people don't have insurance, but they can only afford catastrophic insurance, and so much of the other services that they require don't rise to that level. They can't afford to pay their bill. This law will help that problem. Good for patients, good for hospitals.
That's Pamela Breyer, president and CEO of Maimonides Medical Center. Pamela, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Still with us this hour, Dr. Perry Klass, professor of pediatrics and journalism at NYU, and Nate Persily, professor of law and political science at Columbia University. You know, Nate, we're talking about moving forward and what may come next. But the fact of the matter is that the legal challenges to the Affordable Care Act aren't over, right? I mean, there still are problems that certain states have with provisions, are we done?
Well, I think that, we had half a dozen cases or so that were in the courts. The reasoning in this case is one that's going to sort of settle a lot of the issues that are concerned with the Affordable Care Act. I should say that we haven't paid much attention to, while we talked about spending, to the other part of the opinion, which gets five votes, and that is concerning the Commerce Clause. And so the Supreme Court here has said that this act would actually violate the Commerce Clause, that it would exceed Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. And that is another area of law where we have all kinds of laws that are issued under the Commerce Clause, whether you're talking about the Endangered Species Act, most environmental legislation, all kinds of laws are passed under the Commerce Clause. And Chief Justice Roberts, along with the four conservatives, say that this would exceed Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. But he says, well, fortunately, there's another reason for this law, and that's the taxing power.
Are they really talking about the Commerce Clause, or are they talking more about the Fifth Amendment and the liberty argument, going back to the broccoli?
Well, this has always been an individual rights argument dressed up in Commerce Clause clothing, and that is because what they're saying is that there are limits on federal power which are rights-enhancing, that we don't allow the federal government to do anything it wants, not only to prevent it from, say, invading your speech rights or something like that, but also to cabinet within its proper sphere. So, for example, the Supreme Court had struck down a law, that no one can possess a gun in a school zone. It also struck down parts of the Violence Against Women's Act as exceeding Congress's power. And all of these federalism cases are saying, well, the federal government went outside of its sphere. This is something the states ought to be able to do. And the court here says, and they didn't have to reach this issue because they settled the issue under the tax clause, that you have five votes that say they exceeded their Commerce Clause authority.
But, you know, I guess the frustration of most Americans, whether you're conservative or liberal, and whether you go along with the liberties questions, and I'm sensitive to a lot of them, is that it somehow seems as though in all this Commerce Clause theory that the federal government has a real difficult time getting around to what as a society must we set as a priority. Health care should be one of them. Maybe security should be one. We have a real problem getting to that because of these federalism issues, Nate.
Well, that's right. But this is the persistent issue in American history. I mean, we fought a war over it, after all. I mean, so that the proper balance of authority between the federal government and the states is really the most persistent question in constitutional law and, for that matter, in politics. And that is really one of the issues in this campaign, which is how big the federal government should be, what areas of life should it be regulating, and then it has its own version in the Supreme Court as well.
Perry Klass, I wonder if you would take the last word for us on air. I mean, we're talking about politics, we're talking about legal standards, but in the end, for you, dealing with patients every day, this is about the majority of patients being covered.
I'll just say that regardless of people's political opinions, prejudices, and even what they think would be the best way to fix healthcare, I hope this gives us an opportunity to have a lot of really smart people, people who run hospitals, people who practice medicine, people in the law, people in the insurance business, think as hard as we can about how we can take really good care of as many people in this country as possible.
And this is the first step?
And this is a first step.
It's about the 10th step, though. Yeah. The 20th step, if we go back to 1992, that's for sure.
That's right. And they've been trying it. But there's more to come, that's for sure. We're not done talking about the legal issues. We're not done talking about the healthcare issues. And we're certainly not done talking about the political issues. That is Dr. Perry Klass, professor of pediatrics and journalism at New York University. Nate Persily is Charles Beekman, professor of law and political science at Columbia University. Been with us all hour for a special coverage. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But we want to end this hour with what you're saying about this historic decision.
Hi, this is Kevin from Oxford, Mass. The Supreme Court has just restored my faith in government. Finally, something good. Hurrah!
This is Joshua from Michigan. Having read much of the opinion this afternoon, I wonder how it is that with the IRS having no enforcement ability under this law, how they'll convince people to pay that bill. The law doesn't show that they can put liens or any of their usual enforcement activities against someone who doesn't pay the tax for not carrying insurance.
A listener in Lubbock, Texas says this: freedom weeps today. Where do these pseudo-liberal globalists get off? The American people need to gather their pitchforks and march on Capitol Hill.
And get this from Michael in Pittsburgh, who texted us his reaction. It's a very personal story. Yay, sort of. My employer used to have two options. After the law passed, they dropped the one that covered pretty much everyone 100% and everything 100%. Then we have a baby.
I'm sure that because every American in some way or other is affected by the Affordable Care Act, this has to affect you in one way or the other, and we want to hear about it. Tell us your takeaway on today's ruling by the Supreme Court. Tell us your story about interaction with the Affordable Care Act or the healthcare system in general. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to facebook.com/the takeaway. I want to again give a big thank you to our two guests, Dr. Perry Klass of NYU and Nate Persily of Columbia University. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Celeste Headlee. Special thanks to all of our listeners, including those at KNOW in Minneapolis.
The legal issues are resolved for now. The political ones will be taken up by all of those other voices in our society. From our co-producer, WNYC, I'm John Hockenberry. This has been a special hour of coverage of The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Henry Luce Foundation for Increased Understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Funding for Detroit coverage on The Takeaway is supported in part by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, WKKF.org. The Takeaway is produced by WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.